Hello and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast in which two people read through every single Newbery Medal winning book, and then we talk about it, hopefully, tonight, because I'm Michael, and my co-host,
Rebecca,
is currently having a cough. So it may be a repeat of that one early episode where Rebecca nearly died of asphyxiation while she coughed. So fingers crossed that we can finish this episode. Although, if you're listening to this right now, then that means we did finish it because we published it. So anyway, this time, we are going to be talking about Miss Hickory, which is the 1947 Newbery Medal winner. We're in the 1940s. Things are looking dicey in the United States. You know, so early rumblings of the Red Scare, just dropped a nuclear bomb on a nation that would have surrendered to us anyway without the nuclear bomb, but children's literature was going. Rebecca, before we talk about that,
yes.
Why don't we talk about what we've been reading?
Okay. I'll start with things that I have finished since we did our last episode, which is not very many things. I read Bury Your Dead by Louise Penny, which is number six in the Inspector Gamache series. I cannot remember.
How many are there?
Like 20-something.
Oh my gosh. You're reading these until the grave.
Maybe that's not right, but she wrote her most recent one in 2022. And she started writing them in the early 2000s, so if she did one a year, I'm not sure.
Good for her. Finding your niche, sticking to it.
I enjoyed this one. I felt like there's not very much I can talk about in these books because I think I've mentioned before Michael's parents are also reading them and I'm ahead of them. And
they also listen to this podcast.
Also, I just don't want to give anything away if you're going to read this series because it's definitely, I'm not one that like super cares about spoilers, but I feel like in murder mysteries you don't want spoilers.
That's true.
That's the whole point, right? Anyway, this one was good. I feel like there was too much going on in this book. It was like three different subplots of different like mysteries you were supposed to be figuring out. And I don't know. I feel like it's getting too much. I like Louise Penny, but I always have some reservations and I feel like, I feel like as I'm getting further along, the reservations are becoming more glaring and like the frustrations. So I'm going to keep going with them because they're fun. And she does write a good mystery. So, that was Bury Your Dead. I also finished The Patron Saint of Liars by Anne Patchett. This was her first novel. And it is set in a pregnant women's home in Kentucky in the 60s, I believe. Yeah, and so it's written about this woman who is married and gets pregnant and doesn't really want to stay in the marriage and doesn't really want to have this baby, and she loves driving. So she finds out that there's this women's home in Kentucky, and she drives all the way from California to this place. And this is by far, I think, the weakest novel that I've read by Anne Patchett, which makes sense because it's her first. I did not understand this character's motivation at all. She ends up having the baby and decides to keep it, but decides the only way that she could keep the baby is by getting married. So she gets married to this other rando guy that lives, he's not a rando, he is like the groundskeeper, whatever. So she ends up marrying him so that she can keep this baby. And I'm like, why don't you just go back to your husband? You don't really love this guy either. I just didn't really understand a lot of the motivations in the book. And I was telling Michael that, like, for a book that's set in a very, like, religious, faith-based setting, I feel like they could have done a lot more with metaphor and other imagery that they don't really do. So the book follows three different perspectives. So the first perspective you get is Rose, who's the protagonist, and then you get the perspective of the groundskeeper that she ends up marrying, and then you get the perspective of their daughter that he raises as his own, even though it's not. So anyway, I thought it was, I mean, it was still Ann Patchett, so it was good. Like, it was good to read, and it wasn't hard to finish or anything like that. But having read her other things, this was not my favorite. So those are the only two things that I've finished. But then I'm currently reading, I've been reading Wicked off and on because I started reading it as the ebook through Libby, but that book is really long. So I wasn't able to finish it before I had to return it. But I just bought my own copy at McKay's, so I'll pick that one back up.
It's a bookstore for all of you
out
of Knoxville listeners that we have.
Yep. And then I'm also, I might have mentioned this, but I'm also reading with my coworkers. We're reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Persig, I guess that's how you say his name. And I'm so ready to be done with that book, you guys. So ready to
it's
be done
with it.
It's
not very Zen of you to say.
It's, well, I don't know. I can, this book is very philosophical, but it's also like written by an unreliable narrator who is the author himself. And so it's just, I don't ever know what's meta and what I'm supposed to take as insight and what I'm supposed to take as like, I'm just sick of it. I'm tired of it. And it's like, I'm interested in the subplot that's going on throughout where he's telling his story, but then he'll stop for these long portions of the book where he's like teaching you something. And I just am really, I'm really tired of it. So I should be done within the next week or so. And then I also started listening to King, which is the newest biography of Martin Luther King that's written by Jonathan Eig. And it is very in-depth. It's very thorough. It's a very enjoyable to listen to. But something that is unique about this book is it's the first, my understanding is it's the first the first biography of him that's come out since the FBI tapes were released.
They're not all released yet.
Oh, okay, they're not.
Some of them are still under lock and key until, is it 2028?
Okay.
It's a few more years until we get to find out if Martin Luther King had affairs or not.
I'm still very early on in the book. Like, he's just now married to Coretta, so it's early on. But anyway, great reads. What are you reading?
Just one book, because I read even less than Rebecca. I'm currently reading Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, which is like one of the big like modernist novels, one of the big 20th century novels at all. Like, it's super important, so important that I've already read it. This is the second time reading this in preparation for me and a friend and Rebecca are going to try to read another Virginia Woolf book over the summer. But I wanted to, I hadn't read anything by Virginia Woolf since reading, not this one, but a couple, but it's been a while, several years. So I wanted to dip my toe back in, reread Mrs. Dalloway because I remembered it was great. And it is. I'm about halfway through it. It's awesome. Mrs. Dalloway is a book that sounds really boring to describe, and it might be boring to read for some people. But basically what happens is it's like one day, it's set like from the morning until the evening, in which Clarissa Dalloway, who is like this housewife in London, is preparing for a party. And so she's going around and doing all these things to prepare for a party. And in doing so, she like passes different people in the streets that she knows or talks to different people. And most of the book is her interior monologue about like what this is, like what's happening. And a lot of it's kind of stream of consciousness in that kind of really modernist way of like kind of free associative stuff. And then as she passes people, occasionally it'll jump into these other people's perspectives. And so there's like a former lover of hers that she meets and invites to the party. And then we get his perspective and kind of learn what's going through his mind. And then they like pass by this guy named Septimus, who is like a World War I vet, experiencing like what we would now call PTSD. And so like it jumps into his perspective, and that's very like unsettled. And then we jump into his wife's perspective to see like how she views him, and then his like psychiatrist's perspective, and things like that. So it's this like, if you could imagine like a movie version of this, where it's like this kind of like single take free floating camera that's like just jumping around, like following different people as they're walking around, except that instead of a camera, which would have to be outside of people, it's all interior. Like, you never really leave people's heads. There's no, like, there's very few, like, external, like, descriptors. It's all, like, what people are thinking as they go around. And I think it's, like, very readable. Like last summer, me and the same friend that I'm going to be reading Virginia Woolf with in the summer, we read through Ulysses, which is a book that's kind of like this book in the sense of it's one day and a lot of it's very interior and stuff. And that book was is good, but as I mentioned on this podcast, it's quite difficult and dense at times. And this is not a, like, Mrs. Dalloway is not dense, but it's very breezy in terms of, like, the prose is very clear, and a lot of the stuff that is happening, you know what's happening, as opposed to in Ulysses, where things are very clouded and metaphorical and sometimes hard to parse. But Mrs. Dalloway is a real delight to read, I think. And when I was in grad school, I was under a deadline and had to read it over a weekend, and I could, were I given like a weekend free to myself where I had nothing else to do, I could imagine myself sitting down and reading this for a few hours and finishing it like in a couple of sittings. Cause it, there's not really, there's a few section breaks, but for the most part, there's not like chapter breaks. There's this free flowing narrative that's like jumping around these different characters' psyches that I find just really interesting to read. And the way that these characters' minds work, you know, you kind of never know where they're going to go. Like one minute they might be picking up flowers for the party, and the next minute they're like contemplating like the mortality of humans, or like the thinking about like prehistoric man or something like that. And I don't know, I'm enjoying it. Haven't read it in a while. I don't remember a lot of it from when I read it before, so having fun with it. So that's all I've been reading.
Okay.
Besides Miss Hickory, which we should talk about.
Yep.
So we should talk about the author first, right?
Right.
Which, it's my turn to talk about the author. And normally what I do, because I'm a very astute and in-depth researcher, is when I have to look up an author, I just look him up on Wikipedia and kind of paraphrase the Wikipedia article. However, that was not super helpful this time, because you open up the Wikipedia article for Carolyn Sherwin Bailey, who wrote this book, and it's like a paragraph. And half of that paragraph is just a list of titles that she wrote. And so,
which all sound equally boring.
It's spoilers for how Rebecca feels about this book. But so I had to do some more digging beyond the Wikipedia article. And I came up with an encyclopedia.com article, which I don't know that much about encyclopedia.com. This may all be completely fabricated. They do cite some sources at the end, which is a good sign, but all those sources are in print, and I can't double check them. But anyway, she was born in 1875 in a place called Hoosick, New York, which I think is great, because Hoosick, Rebecca's sick. No, Rebecca's sick with this cough. I'm sorry to the 3,000 people who live in Hoosick, New York, for making fun of the name of your town, but I'm not really making fun
I'm
of
sure
you.
I'm sure we're not the first.
I'm not making fun of you, the people of the town. I'm just making fun wordplay in the grand tradition of the modernist writers such as Virginia Woolf and James Joyce. Anyway, so she was born in 1875. She eventually went to Columbia University through the Teachers College, which, who was the other person who had been through the Teachers College that we read about?
Nobody. We had been debating whether women would have actually been admitted into Columbia.
Apparently, yes. I looked up a list of notable graduates of Columbia University, and there are women all the way back to like the 1800s.
Yeah. Well, part of it was that they would let them into certain parts of the college.
Probably the teaching college,
were,
right?
Like, well, also, anyway, we've talked about this. Like, it's a little bit ambiguous about what part of the college they graduated from.
Regardless, in 1896, she graduated from the Teachers College of Columbia University. However, and that's about as far as the Wikipedia article got me. However, I went to encyclopedia.com, and they came through with a much more detailed article that doesn't really reveal any, like, new depths to this woman's life, but it does give, like, fill in some of the details. Maybe these are depths. But apparently her mother was a teacher and also wrote children's books, and so she kind of, in her career, followed in her mother's footsteps. And apparently her first published work was at the age of five, where she, as a five-year-old, dictated a story to her mother, and her mother sent it into a contest, and it won second prize. $25 in 1880? That's probably more than a lot of publications pay now, adjusted for inflation. So pretty good. She, of course, graduated from Columbia, like we just talked about, And according to this article, she also went to Rome to go to what they called the Montessori School, which I'm not sure what school specifically that is, but Maria Montessori, the Montessori woman, did her education in Rome. So she has Montessori ties. And then she also studied social work. And so her like professional career was between, she did some social work, but she also was a teacher. And then she also became the principal of a kindergarten at one point. And eventually she found her sugar daddy.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not sure if this is actually true, but surely this man had to have been paid way more than she was getting paid. Which is that she married this dude who was a research specialist in radiology at Johns Hopkins, and thereafter bought a 150-year-old home in Temple, New Hampshire.
I think they only spent summers there.
See, a summer home? There's no way a teacher and social worker is paying for a summer home. I'm sure they were in love, but at any rate... at this point, I think she had started publishing. She did some work for the Ladies' Home Journal and also some other like magazine stuff, but she eventually kind of found her niche doing children's publishing. And she did a lot of like short fiction and poetry for children that she published in books. I guess the most notable of which, according to both Wikipedia and Encyclopedia.com, so it must be real, is this book, For the Children's Hour. Which is a collection that she published in 1906 and was apparently in print for 40 years. That was pretty successful. But the reason I mentioned the house that they bought is that this also kind of inspired not just Miss Hickory. It did inspire Miss Hickory, but also inspired some of her writing, which is kind of, I guess, academically respected. So this house had a bunch of old stuff in it from like the 18th century, like a bunch of old books and old like family stuff from whoever had lived in that house prior. And so this kind of like activated this interest in pioneer life and like the colonial setting. And she wrote four books that were basically about like pioneer arts and crafts. And like a lot of critics, according to Encyclopedia.com, think that this is like the actual best material that she did because it goes really in depth with like she did a lot of like genealogical research on like the people who owned this house, and like it's apparently like very rigorous in terms of like actually the information that she does in these books. Anyway, some other books that she wrote: Boys and Girls of Colonial Days of 1917. Broad Stripes and Bright Stars, which is in 1919. Something called Hero's Stories, which is from 1919 as well. The Little Rabbit Who Wanted Red Wings. Apparently Miss Hickory was kind of like at least according to some of the people quoted in this article, was considered a less characteristic work of hers. Like apparently like the kind of fantastical setting, which we'll get into in a minute, that was kind of like not her beat, really. And so this was like a bit of a departure, but it was the thing that she won the Newbery Prize for, the Newbery Medal, in 1947. She died in 1961. She wrote all throughout her life. I just want to end with this quote, which I thought was nice. And I wish that I was more enthusiastic about the book that I actually read by her. but she apparently called storytelling a real force for mental and moral good. And she believed that to be effective, a children's story must be developmentally appropriate. And she believed that stories must be fresh. And critics appreciated that from her. And she liked to have imaginative depth and an evolving technique over all of her stories. And I think that that's nice. Although I think that that also raises some red flags about like how she might have been a kind of overly moralistic person when it came to thinking about children's literature. Some of which is reflected in Miss Hickory, but not so much. So Miss Hickory, you can describe it in a second. The last thing I want to say is that this house in New Hampshire had an apple orchard. And it was apparently her time spent in this apple orchard that inspired Miss Hickory. And so now I'm going to throw it over to Rebecca who's going to tell us about the plot of Miss Hickory.
So let me start with just reading for you what Carolyn Sherwin Bailey says at the beginning of the book. She says, let me find it. She says, except for Anne and Timothy, who are the only human characters in the book, mind you, who have been given those names in place of their own, all the characters in this book are real. They are all living, save Doe, in the places where they live in the book. They all still behave just as they do in the story. And let me tell you guys, that's a lie. Because you know what this book is about.
You don't know this woman's life. You don't know what she's experienced in that apple orchard.
This book is about an anthropomorphized applewood twig whose head is a hickory nut. And she can talk and make her own clothes, as do all the other animals in the woods. And you know what is not real, guys? Animals talking and
now,
living.
Rebecca, we just read a whole book about animals talking not two podcast episodes ago. Dr. Doolittle has a word to have with you.
Okay, so let me tell you what this book is about. This book is about Miss Hickory, who is that very twig with the head of a hickory nut woman. And she starts out the book, this whole book takes place in New Hampshire, and she has been made by Timothy. Well, no.
The girl
Timothy made the house that she lives in. So Miss Hickory is a doll that's been made by her human friends who are apparently not real. But, and she lives in this corncob house that Timothy has made. And she lives next to the home that's in New Hampshire. Well, she finds out that the human owners are relocating. Why are they going to? Okay, so
they're
moving,
like flying south for the winter.
No,
basically.
They're going to Boston. They're going to Boston.
That's right.
They're going to the city because they live in the country. So they're going.
It's like the opposite of that one book that we read where the family.
Right.
The Maple Hill.
They're still going to be cold, but they'll be in the city. So I don't
know. Boston is very cold.
They're relocating there for the winter. And Miss Hickory realizes that she's not going to survive in her home in the snow because it's on the ground. So she has all these friends in the woods that come and help her.
Friends being
or
like a
often
crow
just
and
make
a
fun
squirrel.
Of her. Like they don't seem like so there's a crow who's just named Crow, and then there's Mr. T. Willard Brown, who is a barn cat. and so they come and tell her, like, hey, you know, you're gonna die. You better relocate. The crow helps her find this nest that's been abandoned because the birds have flown south for the winter. I don't think they go to Boston. I think they actually go south. But anyway.
Like reasonable people.
She relocates to this nest. And really a lot of the book is about her learning to accept help and give help to others, even though she's very stubborn. There's this maniacal squirrel that lives down in a hole under the tree that she's living in that realizes that her head is a nut. And so the whole time of the book, she's like, he might like me, he might eat me, only time will tell. Who knows what we're going to do.
Are we going to spoil the ending to see whether he likes her or eats her?
I don't know. Sure.
The ending is quite surprising. Spoilers, plug your ears if you haven't read this book and don't want it spoiled for you. But the spoiler is,
Why are you? This is my turn.
Okay, sorry. Never mind. Erase what I just said.
So, in a fit of concern that she has for the squirrel, she realizes, you know what? I've not heard from Squirrel in a while. I hope he's okay. I think we're friends. So Miss Hickory goes into the hole to check on him. And throughout the whole book, she's like chastising him. His poor mom is dead. He can't remember where he hid his nuts. His head is just all over the place. And so she
his head is all over the place.
She chastises him throughout the book, like, why can't you get anything right? You're eating too much, and that's why you're hungry now. So she comes down to check on him, thinking that, I can't remember the sequence of things.
It doesn't matter.
The crows,
just get to
the crows have come back and, like, basically say, get out of my nest, like, get out of here. And so I think she thinks she's going to take shelter in Squirrel's Hole. I think that's what it is. But anyway, he's down there. The conversation turns south, and he decides, you know what? I am hungry. I haven't had enough. I'm going to eat your head. So apparently, when he eats her head, she still has full... And you guys, this is real. You need to remember. This
it all
is
happened.
All real.
100% true. Just like all those pioneer arts and crafts.
So even after her head is eaten, she still has full control of her body. But she can't... So anyway, she runs and runs and runs until she like gets attached to this tree. And she's apparently... What's it called?
Like grafted?
Yeah.
Like she grafts herself onto this tree and grows.
This tree has not bloomed for however many years, but she's a special kind of thing. I can't remember what she's called. Anyway, once she attaches to this, the tree blooms. The friends, Timothy and Anne, who are not real, come home. And the girl is so sad that she can't find her doll. A chipmunk has also overtaken Miss Hickory's corncob home.
That's one of the inciting incidents.
It is.
Is she leaves the...
Oh, that's right. That's why she had to find... Yeah.
She leaves, like, for a day or something, and then comes back, and this chipmunk is living in her house.
And also, she couldn't have stayed there anyway, because the snow would have made her... She needed higher elevation. So, anyway, the children, like, go. They're, like, so excited that this tree has finally bloomed that never has. The little girl's like, oh, it says... Whatever that word is. Scion. Scion?
I've never seen that word before except in this book.
That's technically what she is that's allowed it to bloom, I believe. Guys, we really know what we're talking about with this book. And that is the end. So
in between,
there's a lot
of,
that happens in between with the animals. There's a really... We'll talk about some of the weird stuff. But
very episodic, though.
Yeah. Which, as everyone knows, is my very favorite kind of book.
It's not.
So, anyway, what did you like about this book, Michael?
I think that most of this is kind of conceptual rather than actual liking. Because I, as a spoiler, was not very interested in this book. But this book does have some very strange turns. Foremost being, like, the body horror that is at the end of the book when the squirrel eats her head. Like, it is like...
It's scary.
There's like a picture, too, of the squirrel eating her head. And then she's walking around without a body. And then she basically like just like grafts onto this bigger tree and like loses her autonomy. I don't know. It's like very strange. And I kind of like... I was really taken aback when I read it. Because the rest of the book is a fairly like grounded like version of like how, you know, life in a forest goes. And I guess twigs can do this to trees, so that is true, that forests can do that. But the fact that her head gets eaten first, but that she still has thoughts and stuff, I don't know, is very strange. And in a book that otherwise wasn't very interesting to me, I do appreciate that it just goes out on this really bizarre, like, if I were a child, I might be a little bit unsettled by how this goes. I like that element of it. I think that there are elements of this book that are funny. And that remind me of, like, maybe, like, Wind in the Willows or something like that, where you have these animals that don't really act like animals. They act like, kind of, like, bourgeois, like stuffy humans, you know, who all have their own kind of, like, temperamental elements of it. And, like, at one point, like, Miss Hickory helps these, what kind of bird is it? Is it pheasants?
They're, yeah.
Yeah, it helps these pheasants, these female pheasant birds, to create, like, a ladies' aid society because all of the men are, like, philanderers and, like,
well,
awful to them.
I think this might be true, is that the...
it all is true, Rebecca.
The men, well, I
Except
think that this
kids.
Is, like, a scientific fact about, like, pheasants, I think, was the way that it was kind of alluded to, is that in the winter, the males won't allow the females to nest with them, I think. That's definitely what happens in the book, but the way she wrote it made it seem like that's a real thing. We'll have to look that up. So they're, like, feeling neglected or whatever. She's like, you don't need them. Just form your own ladies' aid
society.
Yeah, and
they're, like,
let
are
me
basically,
teach you.
Like, biddies, like, knitting and stuff. And they're like, no boys allowed.
Let me teach you how to quilt. And so they just sit and, like, complain about their husbands all day.
I thought that part was kind of
funny. I did, too.
So I like that. there's a few little touches like that too. Like some of the lines are funny, and I can imagine being charmed by that enough that someone would like this book. Overall, it was kind of few and far between for me, but there was, you know, definitely some kind of like cozy comforts to be had, and then all of a sudden the horrific like your head getting eaten moment.
I will say there's foreshadowing for that all throughout, so yeah, I he's probably just like should have been glaring prepared.
At her like the whole book. What did you like about this, Rebecca?
Well, something we didn't mention is the illustration. So this book is illustrated with lithographs by a woman named Ruth Gannett throughout, and I thought they were interesting. I thought they were pretty. So I liked the illustrations. I did. My favorite scene was the thing with the pheasants. I thought that part was really cute. Another scene that I thought was funny was that there's a scene with the groundhog. So basically, everyone knows the groundhog, if it sees its shadow, it goes in. There's so many more months of winter. And the hens are all upset about this, that he's seen a shadow. And I think Miss Hickory is the one that tells them, like, he's just hungry. Throw food down there, and he'll come out, and he'll see the food, and he won't see his shadow, and then it won't be winter anymore. And so I just thought that was funny.
That's like a they good just, life hack. Right. We should try that.
Right. They just usher spring in with that little scene with the groundhog. So I do think I could see what she's trying to do of, like, tie in, like, our own folklore with this imaginary world that she's built and also throw a little bit of science in there. So I do think that's interesting and clever. I thought the corncob house was really cute, and we barely spent any time there.
Because the dang chipmunks come and squat in it.
I know, and destroy it. Anyway, that's about all I liked in this book.
Okay. That brings us to the negatives, which are, I don't have strong negatives. It just was not that interesting to me. Like, there's just not a lot going on. Like, we've made it sound kind of like uproarious and like funny, like what these animals do, but most of it is just kind of dull, like very like homespun, like kind of quaint stories about like woodland creatures just doing
but like
stuff, but not in not a way
very
that's...
interesting characters, like Miss Hickory, we're told she's stubborn, but I don't really think she's stubborn. Like, she's just trying to survive, and she doesn't know who to trust,
and she's also vague. Yeah. Vaguely characterized, I would say, like at some
I don't really understand why. The only reason I know that we're supposed to think she's stubborn is the book flap tells us that she is. Yeah. And like all throughout it seems like these animals are chiding her, but I'm like, what are you actually like chiding her for?
She hasn't let her head get eaten and grafted herself to a tree.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, yeah, I spent a lot of this book thinking, like, what am I supposed to be getting out of this? And like, sometimes these stories take the form of like a morality tale, where like a character learns a lesson. Other times it's just really kind of just, oh, that was a story. Like, what it reminds me of in some ways is those Frog and Toad books.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like the kinds of things that happen, it's just that with none of the wit or the strong personalities of Frog and Toad in those books, and like the repartee between those two characters. And instead, you're just left with, like, oh, there's a chapter in which, you know, she has to look for a new home, and she gets help finding a new home. Oh, here's another chapter in which she has to, I don't know, there's just, like, random stuff that's happening, and it doesn't really build except that the winter passes.
Yeah.
And then, okay, we're going to mention this, I'm sure. This has to come up at some point. But then in the middle of the book, Jesus shows up. Like, Jesus in the flesh as a baby. It's Christmas. So let's set the scene. Okay. It's Christmas time.
We both thought the scene was extremely bizarre.
Very bizarre, but not in a good way, like her head getting eaten at the end. Just, like, bizarre in a what is even supposed to happen way. It's Christmas time. And as all good Christians know, Christmas is the celebration of the birth of that bouncing baby boy, Jesus, who did not cry, not a sound did he make in the manger. And like, okay, so you think I'm being a little bit facetious with this, but no. Like, what basically happens is like the manger shows up like with the baby Jesus, like from like a nativity scene. And all these animals are gathering from like all around the world, not just woodland creatures from New England. Like there's like giraffes and stuff. And
yeah.
And Miss Hicker, everyone's like, are you going to go see this? Are you going to go see this, Miss Hickory? And Miss Hickory's like, oh, I'll see you later. And then she misses Jesus. She doesn't get to see Jesus.
And it's not just alive animals. It's dead animals, too, come back. The squirrel reunites with his mom.
Yeah, like...
And this doe, you guys, that was killed in the book.
Oh, yeah, there's a Bambi moment, too, where this doe gets killed by a hunter.
For no reason except that the fawn becomes friends with this baby cow.
I did find that funny in her introduction that, like, everyone's still alive except the doe.
Except doe.
The foreshadowing. But anyway... this, and then in the chapter, nothing religious is mentioned ever again in this book, nor was it mentioned beforehand. Like, it's just a random Jesus chapter where the point is, I guess, that Miss Hickory didn't have her heart ready to go seek Jesus and missed it. And I don't know, does that mean Miss Hickory's going to hell now? I don't know.
She's still alive.
She's still alive. She's still got time. Someone's got to send her, like, a gospel tract or something.
In the tree.
But at any rate, very bizarre, and not in a way that I found particularly enjoyable. It was just bizarre in a way that I found confusing, because, I don't know, like, it would have been equally bizarre had, you know, I don't know, any other character of historical import, like, figure of historical importance showed up, like, Miss Hickory meets Gandhi, or something like that, like, nothing in the rest of the book prepares you for a book in which people who are important in the real world appear, much less people who, you know, are like the Son of God. Anyway, what did you not like about this book, Rebecca?
I don't have anything to add than what you already said.
Yeah. You know, it's almost been 40 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that this podcast is as long as it is.
I think it's because the books that we talked about in the beginning.
Rebecca.
You did do really good research on the author, though. You really dug for that info.
I dug.
And I found it insightful, so good work.
Good job, encyclopedia.com.
Yeah.
Thumbs up or thumbs down, Rebecca?
A thumbs down.
Thumbs down on Miss Hickory. Thumbs down. I'm sorry, Miss Hickory, if you're listening from your Scion branch in New Hampshire, but you got to have a more interesting life. Maybe if you had asked Jesus into your heart and met him at the manger, he would have had a better story.
It does end with her giving Anne, the one that recognized her in the tree, an apple. Isn't that sweet?
I'm sure the apple was sweet. The moment was not.
I do want to include, this is from the book flap, but whoever said this said that this book is a fantasy full, but it's fancy.
Whoever wrote the book doesn't know what they're talking about. This is rigorous nonfiction.
It is the fantasy full of the peculiar charm of the New Hampshire countryside, seen from an angle which most of us, city-bound in the winter, know little about.
What is this? Do people really go to the city for winter?
Maybe they did when, like, in...
Like, when it was harder to survive a winter?
Right. I imagine so, when you didn't have, like, maybe, like, heat in rural places or all that stuff. Yeah. All that important stuff. So maybe.
I don't know.
Anyway, we did not talk before this episode about what we would read next, but I made an executive decision, if you're okay with it.
If I'm not, then this podcast can get real awkward real quick.
Would you want to do Ginger Pie next?
Is that from the 1950s?
It that's sure our next is. Decade.
All right, Ginger Pie by
Eleanor. Yes. Have you read this one?
No, but members of my family have read it, so I'm
My aware. Parents began it and did not finish it because they found it so boring. So, we'll see.
Well, we'll see whose family was correct.
We'll see.
Anyway, thank you everybody for listening. If you have feedback for us, you know where to find us, newberrychronicles@gmail.com. Let us know if you found Miss Hickory to be a masterpiece on par with Mrs. Dalloway. I have not.
I'm just ready to get back to the 60s, guys. I looked at all the lists of the 60s. I'm so excited. But the 20s through the 50s are pretty dismal.
Rebecca's ready to tune in, drop out, turn on. What was that thing that people said?
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
It's like a hippie
thing. Okay.
Anyway, Rebecca's ready to drop acid and read these cool books.
Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.